This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices, episode 250, was recorded on December 17th, 2020. I'm Eric Townsend. This episode is brought to you by Abex Technologies, pioneering the design of smarter markets that better meet the needs of both market participants and society as a whole, and by the North Shore Global Uranium Mining ETF, ticker URNM, a focused play on miners and holders of uranium. Hayman Capital founder and fund manager Kyle Bass joins me as this week's feature interview guest. We'll discuss why equity markets seem impervious to confirmation of a second wave of COVID-19 and the new commodity bull market that Goldman Sachs commodities chief Jeff Currie described when I interviewed him recently on the new Smarter Markets podcast, along with why Kyle thinks that higher oil prices are the most likely byproduct of Joe Biden's presidency. Finally, we'll talk about Singapore and why Kyle says Singapore is going to be the big winner as Hong Kong loses its independence from China. If you heard my interview with Goldman Sachs commodities chief Jeff Currie on the new Smarter Markets podcast last week, you already know that we're starting a secular bull market in commodities. But with some commodities, such as copper, already trading at multi-year highs, is it too late to get in with new money? Be sure to stay tuned for our post-game segment after the feature interview, when Patrick's chart deck will focus on the big moves in both commodities and equities and consider strategies for establishing new positions in markets that have already priced in big gains off their lows. This will be our last regular format podcast for 2020. For the next 2 weeks, we'll be airing a special two-part year-end series in which we'll take a deep dive on the subject of fiat currency debasement by central banks. Patrick will host the series, and the panelists will be Grant Williams, Ronnie Sterfeli, and myself. We'll discuss everything from the distinction between hedging currency debasement versus hedging inflation, and all the various hedging instruments ranging from gold and silver to Bitcoin to crude oil to base metals to farmland. Part 1 will air at 9 a.m. on Thursday, December 24th, and Part 2 will air early again at 9 a.m. on Thursday, December 31st. Then we'll be back to our regular format with a market wrap and postgame segment starting on January 7th, 2021.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Eric, let's jump into that S&P 500 trading up along its 52-week highs, actually all-time highs, going into a big quad witching. What's your thinking on the markets here?
Well, Patrick, what's going on is we're seeing an explosion, a parabolic rise in COVID-19 cases, hospitalizations, and deaths. All these things are still skyrocketing, and so is the stock market. Now, how is that possible? I've really had to revisit my vaccine drunk theory. What I had been saying is it just feels to me like people are vaccine drunk. They're so taken by the news that they're not paying attention to the risks that still exist in this market. And those risks are that there's always the possibility of complications where the virus is able to evade the vaccine and essentially be immune to it through mutations or some complication in the delivery of the vaccines. There's never been a successful coronavirus vaccine for humans, and this mRNA technology is brand new stuff. So we're in uncharted territory here. We don't really know what's going to happen. So I've had to revisit that theory and realize, well, maybe what's going on is the market is discounting these things, because plenty of people in institutional finance are talking in detail about these risks. So maybe what's going on is the floodgates are only starting to open for a much bigger rally in asset markets that's coming as the market fully digests. Eventually, we do get through the COVID-19 crisis, and we're going to have just a mountain of stimulus that's going to be unleashed on this economy. So, you know, we'll see what happens. But if the vaccines do work and are not compromised by mutations, the sky could really be the limit, especially for commodities. And if you add the possibility of the Georgia runoff elections causing the Democrats to take the House as well, that could increase the amount of fiscal stimulus expectation and even further exacerbate a really strong run in commodities. So this is going to require more conversation, Patrick. I think we should really go deep on this in the postgame segment, and I know you've pulled a chart deck together for just that purpose.
All right, well, let's move on to that U.S. dollar index, because as we're recording this, the dollar is getting hit pretty hard. We're under the 90 level, and I think the only thing that's really there is that 89 support all the way back from 2018. I mean, are we going all the way down there in this push?
Well, yeah, I think we're going at least there in this push. The question is, are we going much lower than that? Because once that 89 support doesn't hold, if we get a clean break below it, there's really not much support below that until you get down to, what, 82 or so? And even then, it's questionable down to 80. So I think we have to really step back and say, you know, big picture here, what's going on? It's game on for the dollar selling off, okay? But what's the game? What game are we talking about? I think what this is about is the market seeing MMT and huge post-pandemic stimulus coming. And again, if the Democrats take the Senate in the Georgia runoffs, that just even strengthens the case. I think that's what it's about. Are we finally going to have what I've been calling the Luke Groman moment? You know, regular Macro Voices listeners know that I've been saying for years, no doubt in my mind, Luke Groman will eventually be proven right about the U.S. dollar. I just thought he was early. Well, I'll take credit. He was early when I said he was early a few years ago. I think it's time for Luke Groman maybe to be proven right about the U.S. dollar, having had its final top and starting a decline that ultimately leads to it being displaced as the global reserve currency. And I think that a sovereign digital currency, which might be a U.S. dollar sovereign digital currency, or it might be someone else's sovereign digital currency, I think the paper dollars days are probably numbered, and I think Gluck is going to be proven right. Is this really the beginning of the big sell-off? It's hard to say. This is what technically should be a bottom here. I would expect at least some kind of bounce because we are oversold. It's time for a bounce. But if that bounce plays out into a dead cat bounce and in a few weeks we see this roll over and we got a closing print, let's say, you know, 88 or below, I think that we're really into big time game on. It's a different game, and we really need to get some more guests on the program to go deeper on this subject. So I'd like to get Luke back. I'd like to catch up with Brent Johnson, see what he's thinking these days, and get some of the other guests that focus on the dollar back on the show as we get into 2021.
Eric, let's talk crude oil, because this rally doesn't quit. The February contract is now $48.55 at the time of recording. And how much higher are we going here?
Oh, I think we're going a lot higher. There's never been any doubt in my mind about that. The thing is, I thought we had a wave lower based on the coronavirus pandemic not being over. I thought that reality was going to hit the market and take us lower, and then we were going to see the really big rally. It's looking more and more like that sell-off just isn't ever going to happen. I think what's happening, Patrick, is that a lot of people are really starting to recognize inflationary pressure and recognize that for macro reasons, not supply and demand inventory-driven reasons, but for macro reasons, oil has to go higher. So that sell-off that I thought might have been coming, it looks like we're going to skip it. Now, remember that this is all happening in an environment where none of those predictions that Art Berman has made about U.S. production falling off a cliff, they haven't even started to happen yet. So we could be seeing just the beginning of something that's going to accelerate dramatically to the upside in 2021 if Art is proven right. Anyway, let's come back to this week's inventory numbers. Crude oil drawing down 3.1 million barrels. Cushing, Oklahoma, building 198,000 barrels. Gasoline, building 1 million barrels. Distillates, building 167,000 barrels. U.S. production ticked down just 100,000 barrels, one tick to 11 million barrels even. Now, some of the estimates that I've seen, and I don't know if this was Art Berman's number or if it was someone else replying to a tweet from Art Berman, who was projecting by the end of 2021, we would see a 5.5 million barrel print on U.S. production. That's cutting current production in half. Now, that's not my prediction. That seems too extreme to me. But we've really got to get Art Berman back in the new year to talk about how much U.S. production could fall off. Obviously, OPEC has some room to make up for that, but they're not going to make up for all of it if it really were to be cut in half. I don't know if that prediction is accurate or if it's just tweets gone wild that I was reading one day. So let's get Art back in the new year to talk about it. But I think we move much higher eventually. Taper reaction to the data this week was steady on the data, then a nice move higher. We're still well above the short-term moving averages. And my trade, which is long the Z1, Z2 time spread, back of curve time spread, is performing beautifully. We're up to about 1.38 as we're speaking on Thursday afternoon, and that's after entering the trade at -3.20, which I called several months ago back here on Macro Voices. So I think we go much higher in 21. Maybe the virus-related stuff does give us some kind of sell-off. I think certainly we've kind of gotten a little bit ahead of ourselves here. But on the other hand, everything I'm hearing on the macro side is more and more people see that we're coming into a real big commodity super cycle upside. And I think this is just getting started.
All right, well, let's move on to gold, because rewinding back to November 9th when the vaccine news was coming out, gold had a $100 down day and broke below its 50-day moving average and been pretty much in a downtrend below its moving averages for over a month. Today, we have a breakout back above the 50-day moving averages, above almost 3-4 weeks of price action. Is this a new breakout in your mind?
You know, it's very, very interesting. What I've been saying is watch what Bitcoin does. And what I've been predicting for a breakout to the upside was not in gold, but in Bitcoin. And sure enough, that happened as predicted. Our friend Eric Peters from One River Asset Management may have been involved behind the scenes. He's running a new fund that reportedly is building a position, which either already is or is soon expected to be over $1 billion in Bitcoin. So Eric Peters buying for his new fund may have helped with the upside that's taken Bitcoin to new highs. The thing that I have to really underscore here is this institutional participation in Bitcoin is profoundly important. My argument all along has been, look, you've got to understand that Bitcoin is something that governments have a strong incentive that if they had their act together, if they were paying attention, they would outlaw it, because Bitcoin poses a very serious threat to the government's monopoly over issuing money. Now, the other thing that I said in my book going back 2 years ago to 2018 is that if you see significant institutional adoption of Bitcoin, that's going to make it politically inexpedient, that it will be impossible for them to outlaw it just because too many powerful and influential people own it. And that's what we're starting to see. So the reason that my view on Bitcoin and cryptocurrency in general is starting to change is not because I've changed my mind about the hesitations that I had, but I've always said there's a certain point of no return where after a certain amount of institutional participation, it becomes inexpedient to outlaw it. And that changes the game considerably. I'm going to ask Kyle Bass about that in today's feature interview. And we're also going to include considerable more discussion of Bitcoin in our year-end special with Grant Williams and Ronnie Sterfeli, which is coming up in the remaining two Thursdays before the new year.
Eric, stop here for a second. For years, I couldn't even get you to talk about Bitcoin. And now you talked about Bitcoin and you didn't even mention anything on gold. What do you think of that breakout, though?
Okay, so what I was thinking before is the reason that I think gold has been so weak. First of all, let's take a step back. I'm uber bullish on gold. I think gold has to go dramatically higher from here. There's just no doubt about it. All the stimulus that we see on the horizon, it's got to go much higher. What I was thinking, and maybe it was wishful thinking because I'd love to see a deep correction so I can buy even more gold, but what I was thinking is, boy, it really, if you look at the fund flows, it's pretty darn clear that what's been hurting gold has been Bitcoin's success. As people see Bitcoin outperforming gold, the fund flows are out of gold funds and into Bitcoin. I thought that the breakout above the previous all-time high on Bitcoin would maybe be the catalyst to unleash another wave of selling in gold as people abandon gold. Big mistake, not the right move, but I think a lot of people might still do it, and buy Bitcoin instead. not a smart move, in my opinion. That didn't happen, but wait a minute, Patrick. This is the first day. You know, you and I are watching these charts. It's only overnight last night that we saw this sudden breakout in gold and Bitcoin. If we're going to see the kind of reaction that I've predicted, which is retail investors who are not that sophisticated just look at Bitcoin outperforming gold and lose faith in gold and they sell their gold and they buy Bitcoin instead. You know, that's the kind of stuff that tends to happen on a Monday morning after they thought about it and decided to do it on the weekend. So I haven't lost faith it completely yet, but so far what we're seeing is it's both Bitcoin and gold breaking out, and I think that is an indication that people really see a mountain of stimulus on the horizon. And holy cow, what happens if in the Georgia runoff elections, if the Democrats take the Senate and we see a doubling in the size of the fiscal spend budget that's anticipated? Then we're really going to see to the moon prices in both Bitcoin and gold.
All right, well, let's touch on that 10-year Treasury yield, because I would have thought that we would have been getting a little bit more response out of this, but really we're pretty much at the same level we were last week, around spot 9.2. What's your thinking here about the yield?
Well, and we're also seeing the yields at the short end of the curve. You know, six-month T-bills are still at 7 basis points. I think when we spoke last week, it was 8 basis points. So the steepener continues. I think the 10-year is likely to still continue to back up, and this is something I'm going to ask Kyle Bass about too, but I don't think the trade here is to start shorting treasuries because you think yields are going to back up. The trade here is to be long commodities. That's really where the action's going to be. And yeah, the move's already gotten started. We'll talk in postgame about how to play that if you're late to the table, so to speak. But I think it's going to be commodities and eventually oil is going to have a really big move up. Copper's already almost doubled off of its March lows. I think it's still going higher. That's where the big action is going to be. So I don't think the trade is going to be shorting treasuries, but I do think treasury yields are going to continue to slowly back up, not nearly as aggressively as you're going to see price appreciation in commodities.
Well, this week's feature interview guest is Kyle Bass. Now, Eric, why did we get Kyle on the show this week?
Well, Kyle has been, I think, our most frequently requested guest for the last few years, and we were finally able to sign him up. And it's a perfect time, Patrick, because Kyle is obviously a very big picture macro thinker. I wanted to ask him what's going on in the market, what's driving this. And Kyle has had a lot of very strong views about Hong Kong losing its independence. But most of what you see in public media coming out of Kyle are his political views. And while I appreciate his passion for his political beliefs, I wanted to talk to him about market implications. If Hong Kong is losing its independence from China, okay, that's unfortunately a big lose for Hong Kong and people in the finance industry in Hong Kong. Who is the benefactor? Who wins as a result of that? So we're going to talk about that in quite a bit of detail.
Eric's interview with Kyle Bass is coming up as Macro Voices continues right after this message from our sponsor.
This episode of Macro Voices was made possible by Abex Technologies, which also sponsors my new Smarter Markets podcast, which airs every Saturday morning and explores how the markets themselves could be redesigned to better serve market participants and society as a whole. My interview with Goldman Sachs commodities chief Jeffrey Curry was fantastically popular with listeners, and I really encourage you to check it out. It's one of the best interviews that I've ever done. But stand by for this coming weekend's Smarter Markets, when my guest will be Abex co-founder Tom McMahon. Tom has been in the commodity markets literally for 50 years. He started as a runner at the age of 13 in the early 70s, and he's been at it ever since. We'll talk about what he learned through all of those decades of experience and what he's working on now. But you won't get Smarter Markets on your Macro Voices feed. You have to subscribe to Smarter Markets separately in order to receive this exciting new podcast. You can find information at macrovoices.com/smartermarkets.
And now, with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is Hayman Capital founder and fund manager Kyle Bass. Kyle, it's great to finally get you on Macro Voices. I think you're our most requested guest ever, which is really great to have you on. here we are, global pandemic, big explosion in cases, hospitalizations, deaths. Monday this week, Mayor de Blasio says, get ready for a possible total shutdown of New York City. Lots of bad stuff going on. Stock market rallying to effectively all-time highs. What's going on here? Is it basically we're in a new market paradigm where it's all about expectations of Fed stimulus? Or how is it possible that we're at all-time highs with really a 100-year disaster on our hands?
Yeah. I tell you, the markets are very good at looking across even the Grand Canyon when you're talking about different shapes of recovery. But I think in this case, we've seen this word is so often used today that it becomes less impactful. But we've seen an unprecedented coordinated global central bank response to the Chinese pandemic that I think the amount of both M1 and M2 in global systems, coupled with the fact that we are getting to a place where we have a vaccine that shows a very effective, response, called 90% plus efficacy in its ability to vaccinate against this horrible virus. And so I think by the middle of 2021, we're going to have a vaccine led boom in global markets, coupled with the fact that we have so much cash sloshing around. That's why you see both stocks and Bitcoin and assets and basically everything you and I can buy is headed to new highs, because we're going to have, I agree with Jeff Currie listening to your prior Smarter Markets podcast, I agree with the view that we're going to see a new secular cycle in commodities because of these two, call it, enormous tailwinds.
Well, great minds think alike. That was going to be my next question. So let's come to Jeff Currie's view, where he says it's not just a new secular bull market in commodities, with COVID-19 being the catalyst to bring that about. But he also said that leads to an inflation cycle that eventually becomes self-reinforcing. Do you agree with the inflation aspect of that as well? And what do you conclude in terms of investment outlook? Do we think about the commodities first and worry about inflation later? Do we start hedging the inflation now? How do you break this down?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know, Eric, if you look around your life, is there anything that you've purchased in the last 10 years that is much cheaper than it used to be? I mean, in my life, whether you're buying farm and ranch vehicles, whether you're buying even technology-based investments, whether you're buying a new PC or you're buying a new iPhone, their capacity has greatly increased, but the actual net price tag has also increased. And the way that the inflation experts using chain weighting calculate inflation, I basically am offended by the fact that people out there don't believe we have inflation already. We've seen enormous inflation, whether you're buying automobiles, houses, technology per storage unit or per cycle unit has definitely gone down in value, but we have many more units in each device. Therefore, the net price is higher. So I expect pretty significant inflation, and it will widen the gap between the haves and the have-nots anymore. And we can expect to see even more social discourse going forward, which will be the negative associated with the positive of, call it, rallying markets and enormous inflation.
And of course, those rallying markets only exacerbate that social divide, because the haves have more and the have-nots have less. In terms of investment outlook, do we think about things like copper and copper miners, mining stocks generally? How do we think as investors about this coming inflation that both you and Jeff see, and also this coming commodity secular bull market? Is this something that you play by holding the commodities, or do you think it's better to be in the mining stocks and other producers? How do you play it?
So, my view is, I think, different than just about everyone's. Everyone has their own view on this. And my view is, in the last few cycles that were secular bull trends in commodities, as you and I probably know, the break-evens in iron ore, break-evens in copper mining companies all continue to move substantially higher because of the inputs, right? The labor, the machinery, the maintenance, the permitting. All of those costs, that all of the input costs that go into mining, the tires and this and that, end up going up. And so while in various periods there's convexity in the equities of these companies, I'd much rather own the pure play. I'd much rather own the commodity itself, because owning the commodity, you're actually the net beneficiary of the shortages and also the bottlenecks in supply constraints and also costs that are factors of each of these businesses. So I tend to lean much more towards the commodity than the companies.
Another point that Jeff Currie made in the interview that you mentioned was he drew a distinction between fiat debasement, and he said we've got plenty of that coming between MMT and what the Fed's already done with balance sheet expansion, and inflation, which really he'd said are two different things. And, you know, gold is the hedge, according to Jeff Currie, against fiat debasement, but oil is a much better hedge against price inflation in the broader economy. Do you agree with that distinction? And is gold still the big play here as the hedge, or are things like copper that we actually need to build out the infrastructure that a lot of people see on the horizon going to end up being a better investment than gold?
Yeah, I would say all the above, because I don't know where investors' capital is going to focus. As we all know, the digital gold of this century has been Bitcoin, and that has probably subtracted net new purchasers from commodity gold in a large way in the last, call it, 10 years. But I do think that, you know, you ask, is oil the hedge? Well, again, there are idiosyncrasies to all commodities. I think if you look towards energy and you look towards the lack of CapEx that's gone into these companies over the last 4 years due to the market both bringing in a new, you know, vertical ESG mentality to investing and or not investing in many of these hydrocarbon based companies. And you also have the market and the banks in the market really lowering their borrowing bases and being much more reluctant to lend to even good energy companies that have significantly more assets than liabilities. So you have a constraint of capital. You have a lack of material capex in this space for a long time. And you're about to see two things happen, in my view. So I'm going to say that energy is a much more convex way to hedge yourself from the enormity of the inflation going into, call it, mid to late 2021. We're going to have a vaccine-led recovery. We're going to have pent-up travel demand, both business and recreational travel demand. Therefore, while I'm not saying we're going to see oil demand go right back to where it was pre-Chinese pandemic, but I do think in a very short term, once the recovery, the vaccine-led recovery happens, we're actually going to see more people travel than have ever traveled before. And so we're going to have, I think we're going to exceed hydrocarbon demand pre-COVID for a short period of time in 2021. And the supply side will not be able to react. So I actually think you're going to see a very large energy move higher.
Kyle, let's move on to fixed income. You know, Jeff Gundlach told us, 4 years ago, that one spot 34, I think, was that was it. The bond bull market was over, and we got almost 100 basis points lower, at least on an intraday basis. Are we finally done? Is the 38-year bond bull market finally done, or are we headed to negative yields on the U.S. 10-year?
Yeah, so that's the best question you've ever asked me. And I believe that we're going to see significant inflation. I think we're going to be able to run it, as the Fed calls it, run it hot for a while, i.e. exceeding the Fed's inflation parameters. But that doesn't necessarily mean we're going to see a major bond sell-off or even have the bond vigilantes, if those that might be still alive, show their faces yet again. Given the amount of debt that the global pandemic has left all of the developed world and even the lesser developed world basically been saddled with, I think you're going to see nominal changes in bond yields. You know, maybe the 30-year U.S. Treasury day is, what, about a 165? You know, could that see 250? It could. But could the short end, do you think the U.S. short end is going to go from zero to, you know, 2.5%? Absolutely not. Even if we run big inflation numbers, we can't afford to let those rates move. So my view is you might see some kind of shocking moves that might move 50 to 100 bips, and those would be shocking. But if you just look back through the history, of this massive bond market rally really since what, 1989 or so. I think you're not going to see any kind of meaningful yield moves higher. I think you're just going to see asset prices move higher.
So essentially, we need to inflate away some of the debt that we've built up because the debt, at least in real terms, right now, just doesn't permit higher bond yields. Is that the gist of it?
That's correct. I just think once you head down this road that the central banks have clearly headed down, there is no turning back. There is no letting the bond market and the market rates dictate where an effective zero real rate would be. So I think we're going to have negative real rates, and I think that's going to further exacerbate the Jeff Currie phenomenon of feedback loop of more and more inflation.
And how does the U.S. look compared to the rest of the world in terms of we're already seeing negative yields in Europe? Do those recover out of negative territory as this inflation begins, or are they stuck there?
No, I think they're stuck. My own view is that Europe's a perfect example. I think last week, Portugal got to a zero yield. I mean, some of the most profligate spenders in Europe being the pigs, right? Portugal, Italy, Greece, Spain, you know, those yields are now, you now have some of those at or below zero. You have Germany negative. I think in a world in which you still see material inflation, I think that the central banks keep those yields pegged. Again, they might allow some flexibility in the beginning, 50 to 100 bips, but I don't think you'll see much more than that.
Let's move on to the presidential election. I think it's pretty darn clear that President Trump, if he's going to pull a rabbit out of a hat, he better do it pretty darn quick here, because it seems pretty certain that Joe Biden is going to be the president in 2021. What does it mean for markets? How does the Biden administration change the macro outlook?
Yeah, so I'll stay away from wherever the Georgia election is going to end up. And let's assume that there is a check and a balance in the system, i.e. that there is a still a Republican-led majority in the Senate, so that there's not a full blue wave. If that's the case, one of the bright spots of a Biden administration will be the Biden Energy and Climate Plan. And I think you're going to see tens of billions of dollars, if not trillions of dollars globally, being spent on, you know, alternative energy, trying to wean the world off of its insatiable demand for, you know, hydrocarbon consumption. And I think when you look at the Biden plan, I think that is going to be one of the core tenets of the best part of the Biden administration. And investing around that is going to be, I think, very rewarding to those that understand where it's going.
And if that is the outlook, I would assume then, going back to what you said earlier, that the play is going to be in oil, not in oil-producing companies, because they're going to be potentially the victims of some of Biden's policies. The result will be higher oil prices. Would you agree with that analysis?
I would agree with that. And I think that there are a couple of reasons. I don't know. I wouldn't even say it's the best play. It's a play. I think that the best plays are going to be on the electrification of transport and all the concentric circles that surround that electrification, some of which, as you know, have already been exploited, maybe fully exploited, like in companies like Tesla. But there are going to be many, many, many concentric circles around the thought about what did the Obama administration miss in their desire to bring alternative energy to the United States. And what the Obama administration learned was that there aren't any real transmission lines from the best areas of our country to develop alternative energy. Let's say the northern panhandle of Oklahoma or Nevada, you need enormous transmission lines to get to places like the Tennessee Valley Authority and get to the West Coast, to get to the grids to propagate that electricity. I think you're going to see a Biden administration come with plans that kind of eliminate and address those specific bottlenecked issues that get us to a better and more electrified economy. The net beneficiary of all of this, so that's the explicit goal. The implicit benefits are going to be, they're going to make it much harder and much more expensive. This gets to your point on whether you choose oil or an oil company or a hydrocarbon-based company or the hydrocarbon itself. They're going to make it much more expensive to explore for, develop, and permit hydrocarbon-based investments, whether it be natural gas or crude. And I think that in itself will have a serious effect on the price, making all of the inputs more expensive. They're going to make the actual commodity more expensive. And that will be coupled with the fact that we're going to have a V-shaped, I think we're going to have a V-shaped acceleration in our economy as soon as the population gets substantially vaccinated, call it middle 2021. So there are two large tailwinds going into a business that hasn't had any real CapEx spent in the last handful of years, and demand will exceed the prior demand peak. So again, we're going to see another, I think, energy super cycle that will both benefit alternative energy as well as old energy, which I don't think the youths in today's markets, the millennials that are running these funds and investing in Robinhood, kind of fully grasp yet, but I think they will next year.
It seems to me, if you think electrification is the big theme, what I feel like everybody's missing is, you know, you can't have this electric vehicle revolution everybody's talking about without rebuilding the electric grid first. The electric grid just doesn't have the capacity to recharge all those electric vehicles. I think that means there has to be just enormous demand for copper. What else does it mean? What are the other implications of electrification of the economy?
Yeah, I think, you know, this is, we get to talking about, you know, China. And in China, people say, oh, they're building so many electric cars. And Secretary Xi has said he's going to, you know, run carbon neutral by a certain day. Well, first of all, we all know that is not the truth, as is normal coming out of the Chinese Communist Party's mouth. But it's important to note that Chinese electric cars are basically coal burning cars. And what I mean by that is, China still generates the majority of its electricity by burning coal. And so while they feel good about driving electric cars, what generates that electricity is still the worst possible commodity on the planet. In the US, what this means is if we are to try to electrify not only the grid in a better way, but to electrify transport, the net beneficiary of that electrification is going to be natural gas. And I think you're going to see both natural gas transport companies continue to do better and better and better in the coming decades if we get to this transformation of America's energy business. And if you just look at the numbers, and even you look at, let's say, a turbocharged adaptation or acceleration into both electric vehicles and the electrification of the grid, I don't even think you see a material impact on hydrocarbon demand until the mid-2030s. Again, that lack of focus on CapEx is going to catch up to the governments that have not focused on that specific governments and markets that haven't focused on that desperate need globally for CapEx in that sector.
You mentioned China a minute ago. I want to talk a little bit about Hong Kong. I know that you've had great passion for the loss of Hong Kong's independence. And I certainly, as a legal resident of Hong Kong, appreciate your concern. But I want to talk about the market implications of that. Hong Kong has historically been the gateway city to Asia for finance. And the whole benefit is Hong Kong, under treaty, was independent under its own democratic legal system until 2047, except it looks like they're not going to honor that now. What does that mean in terms of Hong Kong being the financial center for Asia? It feels to me like it has to be displaced. Who's the winner?
Yeah, I mean, if you were to pin me down and say which city will end up reigning over Asia as the financial center, I would have to say it's Singapore. If you were to ask me, if you'd allow me to say which handful of cities, you know, if you look at the flow of some of the highest amount of intellectual capital in Hong Kong, it's mostly going to go to the UK. It's mostly going to go to Singapore. It's going to go to Sydney. It's going to go some of it to New York, right? Some of it I think you're going to see it disperse, but I think if you're looking for a new financial center in Asia, it will be Singapore, and Singapore will end up being the hub for a lot of the equity and commodity trading in Southeast Asia. And I think that they'll be the net beneficiary. And you probably saw over the weekend, Eric, that the UK, who is offering citizenship to those Hong Kongers that had those special passports, they were processing 5 Hong Kong passports per minute all weekend, for that transition date being January 1st. So Hong Kong's going to lose 10 to 20% of its top minds immediately in the next 12 months. And if they lose 5% of their deposits, Hong Kong's financial markets and banking system ends up detonating. And so get ready for an interesting 2021.
And so what does that mean for Singapore? If Singapore is going to be the new financial center on the scale that Hong Kong was, I know they're already seeing an explosion of high-end real estate. Huge amount of money has moved out of Hong Kong and into Singapore. Mm-hmm. Is the play on the Singapore economy? Is the play on what happens in the Singapore financial system? If you want to invest in Singapore as the up-and-coming place, how do you do that?
Well, the answer is yes to all the above. I think you're going to see, again, asset prices will be agnostic to region, unless it's one of the region that is has, you know, China's heavy hand over it, like Hong Kong. I think you'll see, you know, pretty significant declines in some of the markets there. But I think in Singapore, whether you're looking at real estate or you're looking at equities, or as Eric, I know I've heard in your prior podcast, you and I are both investors in a company. The former Goldman Sachs executive by the name of Josh Crum, who's setting up a new exchange, and he's standardizing commodities trading based in Singapore, and especially in a global LNG contract, which is hard to believe there really isn't a standardized contract. But I think we end up thinking that that is going to be the nexus of Southeast Asia. I don't mean to put words in your mouth, but people like Josh Crum have been so prescient in their views over time that they've chosen the right markets, the right regions, the right macros all together. And they've been able to look 3, 4, 5 years ahead and get to that place. And, you know, someone like Josh Crum would be someone that you should bring on to your show and let him explain his own thinking. But he's someone that I invest in. I invest in him as a person because I love his brain. You should get Josh on and deconstruct his brain about the tokenization of commodity markets and the various dimensions of how Singapore will be the new hub of Asia.
I've been trying to get Josh to do that. He doesn't want the Smarter Markets podcast, which he's sponsoring, to appear to be an infomercial. So he's asking me to interview the subject matter experts. But I do want to ask you about ABIC since you brought it up. And again, listeners, in the interest of full disclosure, Kyle and I are both angel investors in this company. So we do have a vested interest. But something I found interesting, Kyle, is every investor I've talked to has a different concept of what this company is. Robert Friedland had very different reasons for investing than I did. I think of it really as a fintech startup that's mostly about using distributed ledger technology to modernize the way commodity futures markets work. Now, I didn't even get it until I interviewed Tom McMahon for the Smarter Markets podcast, and that interview has not aired yet. It will air this coming Saturday. Until I did that interview, I didn't really even understand the importance of the LNG aspect of it, which I guess for some investors is the whole story. So how do you think about ABIC as a company? Aside from Josh Crum as an individual, what do you think this investment is about? Because I thought it was a fintech thing. Robert Friedland thought it was something else. How do you interpret the company ABIC?
It's a great point. You know, so for me, when I think about what is necessary for the world to be able to trade a commodity that I think will exceed the notional value of crude here in the next year or two, and that will be LNG. And the fact that there is no standardized LNG contract, i.e., it's all bespoke and traded between some of its end users on a conversation by conversation basis. I think getting a hub like Singapore, finding a place where there can be a nexus of the convergence of these players, and that can withstand, let's say, the test of time and location. I think that will be ABIC in Singapore. The same people between the Goldman Sachs and NYMEX and the various players that created or standardized the Henry Hub natural gas contract are the same exact people putting together the standardized contract for LNG in Singapore through ABIC. And so I thought that was enough to make the investment. And the most beautiful part of understanding the many facets of how Josh and his team think are, secondarily, you now have this ability to tokenize commodity markets by bringing in blockchain. Again, you can't talk about creating new markets and new technology at the same time. But if you want to start bringing into this aspect of commodities trading the ESG, let's say, global citizen desire to kind of trade hydrocarbon-based commodities that maybe even have a carbon offset attached to them, the opportunities are endless. And it's very similar to the way that, like Jeff Currie said, how we eliminated acid rain by creating the catalytic converter and making sulfur something that we all must deal with. It's been dealt with. There's no more acid rain. I think the fact that we have the ability to now tokenize all commodities trading and basically like they did with blood diamonds in Africa, we can start thinking about cleaner commodities. We can think about the social welfare of the need to trade these kinds of commodities in these areas of the world. And there is no team better than the ABEX team that's been put together, again, with former Goldman partners and NYMEX heads. I think you have a great team. And again, they've already achieved something pretty substantial. The Singaporean authorities have granted them the ability to create this exchange. And they're very close to finishing creating the first exchange for a standardized LNG contract. So I think this is the beginning of a pretty interesting wild ride in the tokenization of commodity markets.
That's very fascinating. So you see it first as the LNG contract in the energy market, which makes perfect sense for Singapore because it is an established energy trading hub. I tend to focus on the longer term picture of who's going to redesign markets to embrace secure digital bearer instruments. Let me run the scenario by you. If that works and it's a threat to U.S. markets, what does that mean in terms of relationships? You know, we've seen a lot get lost to Asia. And in this case, we've got not only American invented technology that's being used here, but there's a lot of American guys that are involved in this particular venture and Canadian guys that are building something which, for a lot of regulatory reasons, is going to be domiciled in Singapore. When this gets to the point where it's a threat to ICE and CME Group, what does that mean in terms of the international relations aspects of it?
Oof. You know, we had a big weekend in the last, call it 3 days here. Today's December 14th, the date of this podcast. And I think that what we've seen is the Chinese Communist Party documents released over the weekend that show where 1.9 million members of the Chinese Communist Party are embedded in various government supranational institutions as well as corporations. So when you think about the domicile, we think about where the risks are to the world and how this technology might be misappropriated, I think Josh has got his hands full. But I think as we move forward, there's got to be somewhere in Asia that runs a rules-based English law version of a high-growth area like Singapore. And I think, you know, I think the world's money is starting to move towards that view. I just think that whether you're looking at Josh or Andrew or Catherine or Jeff or Margo that are all there, I think you realize that they foresaw what was coming, and maybe they weren't counting on China abrogating its contract with Hong Kong a few decades early, but they will be the net beneficiary of that abrogation. And it will just accelerate this move towards, again, standardizing not only LNG, but other commodity contracts over in Singapore. And I think it will be a new high velocity exchange. And you said, what does that mean to CME or ICE? Well, CME or ICE will end up either having to create something on their own or acquire something. So, I think the sky's the limit to what these guys are doing.
Moving off of ABEX and going just back to Singapore as a new financial center, you know, when I moved to Hong Kong in 2009, I evaluated both Singapore and Hong Kong, and it was because of the treaty that I felt like, okay, I'll be pretty old in 2047. I knew that Hong Kong would eventually be annexed into China, but I figured there's a written treaty. I'm good till 2047. Do we need to be worried that Singapore is eventually going to be annexed into China? I mean, they're physically a little bit further apart, but what are the potential risks there?
Yeah, I mean, I think the world needs to be aware of the fact that China is the largest risk to democracy globally. And I think that whether you're in Singapore, and whether you're in Hong Kong, or whether you're in Cambodia, or whether you're in Vietnam, or the Philippines, or anywhere over there, China is a menace. It's a menace in the South China Sea. It's a menace both economically and technologically. to all developed democracies around the world. You see it daily now in the press. So the answer is yes. You know, it's a real risk. It's a real risk that instead of conducting a cyber war or an information war or an economic war, which are the three wars that China has been fighting with the West since the early 2000s, you know, we just have to hope things don't go kinetically. And what China does with Taiwan in both the near and the medium term, I think is going to answer your question better than I can. But if you see China move on Taiwan, then I think Southeast Asia is all at risk. So, you know, when you moved to Hong Kong in 2009, Hong Kong was a very different place than it is today. Over the weekend, we literally saw the billionaire founder of Apple Daily, Jimmy Lai. We saw him in shackles. I mean, are you kidding me? You need to put a 70-year-old in shackles for some sort of sedition because he reported on the heavy-handed nature of the Chinese Communist Party. If that isn't indication enough to you to get out of Hong Kong, I don't know what could be.
Moving on from Singapore, Kyle, what else are you and the team at Haman thinking about in terms of the macro landscape?
Yeah, you know, one of the topics we danced around here but not really addressed is cryptocurrency and specifically Bitcoin and how that either does or doesn't play into macro-based investing or hedging or how you think about life going forward in the next 10 years. So I'm curious to get your view on how you think about it, and then I'd love to share mine.
Well, my view is changing. I wrote a book about this in 2018, and at that time I said, look, the things you need to understand about Bitcoin are, number one, it is strongly in government's best interest to outlaw it. And so far, they've been very slow to do that. But it is in their best interest to outlaw it. And don't believe the nonsense you hear about how it's impossible to outlaw it. That's just not true. I also said, though, that the longer they go without outlawing it, and the more institutional adoption that it sees as an investment asset, the harder it will become politically for them to eventually outlaw it. And I very much still think that, and we've seen so much. I didn't think we'd get this far, but we've seen a lot more adoption. Our listeners have heard me say this 1,000 times over. You never, and you know this better than I do, Kyle, but you never want to make your bets based on what you think is right and what you think the market and the world should be doing according to you. You got to look at what the world is doing around you. And as much as I think that Bitcoin is seriously flawed for a long list of reasons that are in my book, you know what? The rest of the world doesn't seem to be reading my book, and they're buying it. And what I see that I think is a very important trend is Bitcoin is taking market share from gold. And you could look at that as an opportunity to buy the dip in gold, or you could look at it as the beginning of a new trend where, even though I don't agree with it, we're going to see a new generation decide that the scarcity asset that you use to hedge fiat debasement risk is not gold anymore, it's Bitcoin. And I think that's silly for a number of reasons, but it seems like it's maybe what's starting to happen. And I'm starting to think that you almost have to have some kind of hedge, a long Bitcoin position, not because I believe in Bitcoin, but because I do believe that a whole lot of people don't see the shortcomings that I see in Bitcoin.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, you and I have somewhat similar views here. I think that Bitcoin is definitely it's the millennials' gold, and we've seen adoption begin to move institutionally over the last year or so. And I think that adoption is going to take it to new highs, and that means that I think it's a tradable asset. But I would agree with you if you put myself into the role of finance minister or head of the treasury of any of the major Western nations, it's kind of the antithesis of the economic system and the manner in which these governments operate, i.e. one of our sharpest swords here in the United States is our ability to impose economic sanctions, including in the most egregious examples, removing countries from the Swiss system. And if we get to a ungovernable global currency where just scarcity equals value and it becomes untraceable and or more difficult to trace transactions, I think that's, again, it's antithetical to the manner in which Western democracies operate. I think that there are plenty of levers that can be thrown to challenge new entrants. So I've always thought that Bitcoin's success will actually be its failure or its own stumbling blocks, i.e. the more it becomes ubiquitous and the more it becomes standardized, the more governments are going to have to pay attention to it and also look to regulate it from an AML KYC perspective, which is these Bitcoin trading houses are starting to do to weed out the criminals, which I think is necessary. But then also from a perspective of maybe if we count it as a commodity or if it's deemed to be a currency, then wherever Bitcoin is trading at year end, you could be forced to pay capital gains tax on it. And it will always be short term, right? Just like owning bullion or owning a futures contract. Even if you haven't sold the contract at year end, your mark to market happens and you pay gains. That could slow down the adoption of these types of inflation hedges. And I think that those taxes are coming.
Kyle, I want to ask you, how close do you think we are to the point where it becomes politically inexpedient for outlawing it to be an option anymore? Seems to me that like they could still outlaw Bitcoin, but boy, if we get a whole lot further down this path, it's going to be hard to do that politically.
So I actually don't believe that you'll ever see a prohibition or an outlawing. I think what you're going to see are many tethers attached to it that make it infinitely more difficult for it to achieve all of its objectives as the people in Bitcoin are hoping it can. Meaning, again, you may have short-term taxable gains or losses applied annually. You might have to do full disclosure on your tax return. If you don't check that box that says, I own Bitcoin or I own cryptocurrency and here are all of my transactions, and you get caught, that is an immediate, could be a felony punishable by multiple years in prison and disgorgement plus reparations on gains plus interest. So there are plenty of things that can happen that will make it much more difficult for it to achieve its objectives. And I think that's what you're going to start seeing. I don't think you're going to ever see just an outright prohibition.
But the headwinds keep getting stronger and stronger along the way. What else do you guys, are you starting to consider a position in it because of its popularity? Are you still skeptics, or where are you at with respect to Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies?
For me, when you say a hedge, you know, would anyone put 1% of their portfolio there? Yes. Would anyone put 5% of their portfolio there? Probably. But is it something that could move? If you woke up tomorrow and Bitcoin was down 20% tomorrow, you'd say, well, yeah, it's down 20%. It's not really a store of value, right? It's a speculative trading asset. And that's why it doesn't have any real tangible percentages of people's net worth. I realize there are people in there that are making billions and making fortunes by being early and long. But they've also suffered enormous bouts of volatility. And I think when you have global, you think about the G7, G7 currencies don't move 20% in a day. They don't move 20% in a year normally. So I think it will remain a tradable speculative asset. But for us, we're not participating. And in the interest of full disclosure, we did try to participate a few years ago, and we hired armies of lawyers. And we got to this point where we couldn't comply with SEC law because it's not a bindable asset. And we couldn't find a true institutional custodian a few years ago. And a few years ago means we tried when it was $2,000 a coin, not $10,000 a coin. So here, we're not spending a lot of time trying to figure out how to make it an investment in our portfolio. I think you're going to see population demographic trends in the U.S. are going to intensify over the next decade. And I think they're, let's say, better risk-averse ways to make exceptional returns over the next 10 years.
I agree with you. And, you know, obviously, as you say, people have made an absolute fortune on this thing. People are going to continue to make an absolute fortune on this thing. People made absolute fortunes on tulip bulbs, too. It was just a question of being lucky to be in the right place. You couldn't make logic and, you know, intelligence-based decisions on when the tide was going to turn. And the things that I think most people are missing, first of all, there's very little understanding. You know, what's the intrinsic value of Bitcoin? Intrinsic value is a pretty well-defined term. You can't get even people in finance that specialize in this stuff to agree. A lot of them think that the electricity consumed in the hashing algorithms in order to mine the Bitcoin becomes intrinsic value, which is just nonsense. But people really believe this stuff. And at the same time, I think a lot of people don't understand that distributed ledger technology is advancing. We're not going to need mining anymore in order to have distributed ledgers work and work at a much, much more functional level, several orders of magnitude, better performance without mining than with it, as soon as we get rid of proof-of-work validated blockchains and use better distributed ledgers. This goes back to Upton Sinclair's famous quote, you know, you can't get a man to understand something if his salary depends on him not understanding. And what it will take for Bitcoin to do the right thing, which is ditch blockchain and replace it with a non-proof-of-work dependent ledger system, is going to be for the miners to say, hey, we're irrelevant now. It doesn't make any sense for us to continue to exist. Let's just accept this and move on. It's going to be very hard culturally for the Bitcoin community to accept that mining needs to go away. And that leaves room for a new digital currency system, whether it be a Silicon Valley digital currency or even a sovereign digital currency, to come in with a better distributed ledger and steal the show. And I don't think a lot of people understand that. So I think we're very much of the same mindset on that. Anything else on your mind in terms of what you guys have on the macro radar?
Sure. I'll leave you with one last thought on Bitcoin, though. You know, I think the speculative frenzy has definitely not peaked. And if you were to draw an anecdote back towards the tulip mania, if you remember, the one tulip, the most coveted tulip back during tulip mania was this tulip called the Semper Augustus. And the Semper Augustus actually got to a point, it reached a level that actually priced about the approximate nature of a house in Holland, right? I.e. the full investment of a dwelling is what that reached. So if that is any kind of indication of to where Bitcoin's going to go in its speculative frenzy, I think it still has a much higher price we're going to see again. But I think fundamentally, organizationally, governments can't let it be what it is today. So I agree with you on there. But I also am going to tell you that I think you haven't seen the hockey stick yet.
I agree with that. Now, I think that could mean a pretty big downdraft for gold. So many people are going to watch Bitcoin break to new all-time highs and say, okay, look, these gold bug, you know, boomer types don't know anything. It's all Bitcoin, baby. Forget about gold. And I could see a lot of younger people selling all their gold to go buy more Bitcoin and chase it higher. Do you think that's right? And if so, how low can gold go as a result of the Bitcoin drain effect?
Boy, that's a great question. When I see global central banks continually acquiring gold. And when you look at China, China will never publicly mention what it's doing with gold. It just continues to mine it and keep it. Because I think it takes a page out of Keynes's playbook. You can't have a complete fiat-based currency without some sort of underlying value. And I think when you look at what these countries are doing, the developed world is doing with its gold and its central banks, I can't imagine that there are many millennials left that own gold. So I would say that you're not going to see an enormous gold sell-off if Bitcoin hockey sticks. I think you'd see gold flat to higher in that environment. That's just my view, and I know that conflicts with yours. I think we've already seen the millennial picture of selling gold.
Well, Kyle, I can't thank you enough for a terrific interview. I'm going to take your advice to heart and try to get Josh Crumb to come on the Smarter Markets podcast and talk about all of the different things that they're doing there. I may need your help, though, because he's been resistant so far.
We can make that happen.
Well, maybe we'll just get listeners to beat him up on Twitter or something. We'll figure it out. In any event, Kyle, I'd love to welcome you back either to Macro Voices or the Smarter Markets podcast. We'd love to get you back and continue the conversation. We're going to leave it there for today's interview. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back right after this message from our sponsor.
You
Uranium, the fuel for nuclear power, is a contrarian investment whose returns are historically uncorrelated to other asset classes. Low uranium prices lasted for many years after the Fukushima meltdown, leading to substantial supply destruction. At today's prices, uranium mining is uneconomical even for the world's lowest cost producers. Uranium demand is already estimated to exceed existing supply, and future demand growth is expected. New mines aren't economically viable at today's prices, leading analysts to predict that the price of uranium may need to double to over $60 per pound to incentivize sufficient new mine supply to meet expected demand. The NYSE-listed North Shore Global Uranium Mining ETF, ticker URNM, offers investors exposure to both miners and holders of uranium. For more information, visit urnmetf.com.
Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, it was great to finally get Kyle Bass on the show. I really want to expand on his commodity theme in this week's chart book. But before we do, what were your takeaways from the interview?
Well, Patrick, clearly the takeaways have to be, number one, Kyle Bass listens to Macro Voices, and therefore you should too. And number two, Kyle Bass listens to Smarter Markets, and therefore you should too. But let's focus, Patrick, on the substance of what Kyle said about this commodity market. He's agreed with Jeff Curry. I know you and I agree with both Kyle and Jeff Curry. Let's get into a chart deck where we can really go deep on this subject. Listeners, you'll find the download link in your Research Roundup email. If you don't have a Research Roundup email, it means you're not registered yet. Just go to our homepage, macrovoices.com, click the red button that says Looking for the Downloads. Patrick, the chart deck is titled Tactically Trading the Commodity Cycle. What do we mean by that, and what's the backstory here?
All right. Well, I wanted to divide this into three particular segments. First, I just wanted to talk the S&P because it's a very important moment in the market. So we'll talk S&P. Then I wanted to take a bigger picture look at the long-term charts of commodities and where we are in that much, much bigger cycle. And then zoom in to really see where we are over the last couple months, because I think that we have to look at things in different layers that way. So looking at page two, I just really wanted to touch on the S&P 500 chart. And like we were talking about, we're trading up along the 52-week highs. But it was interesting, Kevin pointed out in his Macro Tourist blog about the big Tesla index rebalancing that's happening tomorrow. We're recording this on Thursday over the weekend. And what was particularly interesting was that fact that some of these, the SPY index itself has to do some pretty aggressive selling on some of the big mega caps in order to make room for Tesla. And as an example, was Apple has 42 million shares to sell, Microsoft 20 million shares to sell, Amazon over a million shares to sell, Facebook over 6 million shares to sell. And so it'll be really interesting as we get into this rebalancing over the weekend, whether that will result in some volatility emerging in this after the quad witching option roll-off this weekend. So it was very quiet. The gamma pins were all around this 3,700 level, which is where the market is. It looks like it's likely to set in going in there. And so one of the big things to watch going into the holiday weeks is whether or not once the market gets unpinned and rebalanced, whether the volatility returns. And that's what I'm watching. So I wanted to go to page three, where I just have the long-term chart of that Bloomberg Commodity Index futures contract. And what I have here is the volume by price bars all the way on the left-hand side. And what they're really showing is the levels where the majority of the volume transacted over this period. And the dark color parts of that are where the majority is 70% of the volume lies. And so what we can see is that the commodities sold off very, very hard into that COVID period. Obviously, this index is a bit overweight oil, so it certainly had a very volatile event on the COVID March crash. But you can see that we're really rallying back to the levels where the majority of the transactions and levels where we traded through 2016, 17, and 18 2018 and 2019. And so we're just entering a period where the majority of the bear market in commodities transacted. And so the real bull market in commodities is still ahead of us, is the real key that I want to take away. I mean, if we really are talking a big commodity bull market where this thing is making all-time new highs, you've missed nothing yet, right?
Well, Patrick, and I think it's particularly instructive to look at a chart like this relative to something like copper, which has gotten a lot of attention lately. Now, copper has almost doubled off of its lows in March, and it's actually reached, I think it's a six-year high. Clearly, broader commodities are nowhere close to that. I don't think copper is exceptional or extraordinary in that it's the only one that's going to go to a six-year high. I think it's going there first because it's got so much attention being placed on it because of the electric vehicle revolution and the expectation that the Biden administration is going to focus a lot on the green economy, and that's going to do very well for electric vehicles and for copper. But look, the bigger trend is the commodity cycle, and the broader commodities are just getting started here.
Now, Eric, you mentioned copper, which we're going to get to a chart of copper in a moment because I want to talk about that. But one of the reasons that the Bloomberg Commodity Index looks that way is when we look on page 4, when we look at crude oil's continuous contract, we can see the weighting in that Bloomberg Commodity Index is driving or being quite influenced by the commodity price of crude. And so as crude, if that crude oil bull market was to ever begin, which is something that obviously is a part of the narrative that that we've heard throughout the show, that certainly would drive the bull market in that broader commodity index. And crude oil has really still has room to go to get back to the levels it traded in 2018 and 19, which is just above here. And so, you know, one of the things that I'll be talking about later when we get to some of the other charts is just a little bit how overdone some of this short-term move is. But certainly, this is far from a big new bull market in crude oil yet. I mean, we're still just getting off of those worst levels, right?
Patrick, we're back into a range where it's not crazy low anymore like we were in the depths of the coronavirus crisis. But, you know, it's definitely not crazy high either. We were trading well above $50 before the crisis began. And at that time, everybody was feeling that like that price was a little low and maybe we're going to head back to 75. I don't know how long it's going to take to get back to 75, but I'm sure we're going to get there. And the big question in my mind is whether or not these prognostications about a huge decrease that some people think is unavoidable in U.S. production are really going to come true. If they do, you could see a really big price spike up to $100.
What's interesting, though, Eric, is if we go to page 5, where I have the natural gas futures, I also put on that 4 or 5 years of price action on here. And you can see that a very similar situation arises where we can see that we had the lows already established this summer, which were trading near their 2016 lows. And natural gas has started the process of recovering. Now, we're at a level at this stage where the longer-term term structure of nat gas is actually has its bottom end of its ranges. And so we're now in a period of short-term seasonality where we're deep into the, or just at the start of the winter, where a lot of this has already been priced in. So it'll be really interesting to see whether natural gas here really can stabilize and then use this as a base from which later in 2021 begin a new, more bullish advance on the upside. And that's certainly something I'm going to be keeping an eye on.
Patrick, let's move on to page 6, copper futures. Now, this is one I really want to ask you about how to get into the long side of the trade on when it's already moved so far and we're at multi-year highs already. There's no doubt in my mind whatsoever that copper eventually moves higher because copper is going to be at the center of the electrification of the economy. Talk to Kyle Bass in depth about that subject in today's interview. I really, really want to be long copper for the long haul. But hey, wait a minute. It's almost doubled in price since the March lows. What do I do here? Is there some magic option strategy that's going to make up for any downside risk? How do I get into this thing?
Well, you know, the first thing, well, I want to talk about some of the option strategies around it in a moment, but I wanted to really highlight here just that this rally in copper has been quite significant. I mean, it's been relentless in its rise. We're still not, though, 100% off the lows yet. And when you look at futures markets like lumber and other places like that, which have had extraordinary runs, we've seen a lot more upside there that really kind of shows that if copper really starts to get rolling, there is definitely potential for upside. To be honest, what I didn't show on this chart was the rally copper had from 2009 through to 2011 after the great financial crisis. And in that period, copper went from $1.50 to $4.50, going up several 100% during that advance. And so with copper here already making this push, while it does actually look like a really big move, I mean, just to return back to those 2011 highs is still another full dollar higher. And that's not even making all-time new highs. And so the move is very extended. And I want to talk about that in a moment. And there's certainly room for us to keep bulling copper. The question really is, it's not that asymmetric at this moment. And it's a little trickier to actually manage the risk. You almost have to, at this stage, get in and just hope that the momentum keeps going. Otherwise, any mean reversion would cause a quick and fast stop out on the trade. And that's the tricky part, which we'll talk about in a moment, of how to trade around copper, because it has been just one of the strongest commodities out there. What is another market that's been also very strong, though, Eric, has been the iron ore market. And on page 7, I'm showing the chart here of iron ore futures. And what is amazing is that they have just broken out with some real velocity. And that's translated into a lot of the iron ore equities having a really good run as well. But there was a very long and pronounced established base for iron ore for almost 3-4 years. And really, we've seen now the breakout that is just setting in motion a potential new multi-year bull market in this iron ore space, which has really sent many steel stocks and basic material stocks running quite a bit.
Let's move on to gold, Patrick. It feels like maybe we're about to see the breakout of what could be a bull flag pattern here in gold and a new move to all-time highs. I'm still hopeful that there's a chance that Bitcoin's very strong success, which I think is going to continue, might take some of the wind out of gold sales and give us another sell-off. But frankly, I'm losing faith in that view. What do you see here on this chart?
Well, you know, Erica, it's not that I disagree with that view about Bitcoin. I just don't. I look at it that if you have a broader debasement right across the board and commodities generally are in a bull market in that period, maybe there's a little bit of tailwind gold may have to share with Bitcoin. But I think that there's plenty of opportunity as the tide comes in for all boats to rise with the tide. And that's all commodities rising with this debasement. And so I still am very bullish gold. And you can see that core base down near 1300. And I've known that several people that have suggested that we could have a correction that deep. I'm a seller on that idea. While, I mean, it's entirely possible that gold could surprise everyone with a dip towards 1700, I think that all you need here is gold to catch a little bit of tailwind, and we could be north of 2000, and traders will be quickly coming right back in there to trade the next bull advance higher. And so I think that the gold's chart still looks structurally very bullish. But what another takeaway, though, on the gold market here is it goes to show you what happens and how long bull markets can run. A lot of the other commodities we've shown have just started to break out over the last 6 months. But really, when you can see on gold's chart is that back in 2019, when it finally broke out, it's just been a relentless rally in the year afterwards. And I think that many of these commodities, whether iron ore, copper, or any of the other ones we're looking at, once the bull market really starts to get in place, these multi-year bull markets can stay in place for years. And that's the big bull commodity narrative that we talk about. And I think that's really what I wanted to capture in this.
Patrick, I want to shift gears now because we've been talking about the commodities themselves. The way a lot of people invest in these commodities is to buy the commodity-producing companies, the equities. And frankly, a lot of them have seen a pretty good run here. So let's move in. We've got a new section here starting in page 9, and page 10 starts to get us into some of these companies. Boy, look at that 68% rise on page 10. Does that mean it's just getting started, or does that mean it's due for a big pullback?
Right. And this is actually the part that is the tricky part, because now they're just the way investors chasing Bitcoin. There's a little bit of FOMO kicking in on these breakouts on some of these resource stocks. This is Vale here on page 10, the Brazilian iron ore name. And what we have here is that just in 1 month, we've seen a 68% rise in the stock as it's gone from $10 to $17. And while there's nothing stopping it from continuing to rise several dollars higher, the problem we are presented with as traders at this situation is that it no longer represents an asymmetric entry. I mean, the management of stop losses here versus the potential upside becomes a little trickier than if you got in at the beginning of the breakout using even the most basic technical technique like a crossover of the 50-day moving average. And so the question now is that there's this bull market that we just spent, you know, 9 slides talking about. That probably will continue for a foreseeable future. But the question is, do you just indiscriminately buy these resource companies at this level because you know that over the long term, they're going to be fine? The reality is that if someone buys many of these stocks, you're probably going to have to weather some mean reverting retracement that in many cases be a 20, 30% pullback off their highs. And that makes it really tricky. You have to really have that longer term conviction to hold through those types of corrections if you start buying here. And this is where we use a lot of option strategies to manage this. It's about how do you at these stages participate in further gains on the upside, but yet tactically leave room for the opportunity to be able to reposition yourself on dips. And this is where with a lot of these strategies, we use things like collars or participate on the upside with debit spreads and have different mechanisms from which we manage this stage where we're in a cycle. So we're in this big daily chart advance that is really already had. I would argue that maybe this is in this daily chart cycle in the seventh, eighth innings of this particular advance. It doesn't mean that these stocks aren't going to keep going higher, but the bigger question is how do you manage through these different cycles?
Patrick, let's apply these concepts to an actual chart. Let's look at U.S. Steel on page 11. What do you see here?
Well, exactly. Like U.S. Steel over the last 2 months has basically gone from $7 to $20 and you make it almost a 200% run on the upside. And so steel and iron ore and all of these things are now hot. Aluminum, like Alcoa, everything is just working. And so U.S. Steel has made this run and it may very well continue. I mean, we may see U.S. Steel in the next year trade as high as $30+. But as somebody here on U.S. Steel would probably have to be willing to ride through a $3 or $4 pullback at some point where a retracement heads to $14 or $15. Now, typically a trader would say, well, that's fine. I'm just going to stay in cash. I'll put my limit orders down at $14 and $15 and I'm going to just wait for the stock to come down there for the buy on dip. The problem with using a traditional limit order waiting for a price to, level to hit is that if the stock never gets down there, and it blasts off in, into the next move, then you're chasing and you're not participating on the upside. And this is where one has to come up with some different strategy on, well, how do I at least have some strategy in place that if U.S. Steel just goes for another $5 advance and goes from, let's say, $18, $19 to $24, that I'll participate, but yet have only a some skin in the game while I'm waiting to see if the bigger buy-on dip comes on the downside. So on a stock like this, one of the things that I would consider doing is implementing bull call spreads on the upside of U.S. Steel with a small amount of capital, like $1 or $2 per share debit. And in doing so, you're risking a small, modest amount to discover whether U.S. Steel is just going to keep ripping like Bitcoin style on the upside. At the same time, the majority of your cash is sidelined waiting for that buy on dip opportunity. And so it's sort of about how you find some tactical strategies to continue to trade around this position without having the stress associated with the fact that like you feel that you've missed it, right? Another good example of this, Eric, is going to page 12 with Freeport-McMoRan. Now, at Big Picture Trading, we were fortunate enough to publish to our members an $8 call option back just off the COVID lows, and we participated with a leap option on the majority of this upside. And this is an example of how to trade this, because while that option that we bought for $3 is now worth like 17 bucks, the thing is that we have this option out to 2022. And we are very bullish copper, and we think that Freeport can keep going. But really, at some juncture, Freeport-McMoRan is going to have some mean reverting correction. And after a big run, there's this natural impulse to want to take some profits, get moved to the sideline on it. And so this is a balancing act of how you manage this position. In this case, because our option is slowly approaching a Delta 1 position, because we just have so much intrinsic value built into it, we are actually treating our position as though it was an equity position. And we've implemented a collar around Freeport-McMoRan to actually lock in this gain, give further upside, and be able to actually weather a pullback and, in fact, potentially monetize or even pull out some intrinsic value in the protection if there was a correction. And so we're trying to determine all sorts of really interesting ways of managing the position without selling it.
So the name of the game here, Patrick, is knowing which option strategy to apply in order to participate in the upside without being exposed to unlimited downside if there was actually a trend reversal.
That's right. And what's really interesting about this is that this truly is a commodity breakout right across the board. I know a lot of people have been talking about those energy stocks coming off their worst levels and the percentage gains. But, you know, if you go to these agricultural stocks, I have here on page 13, Mosaic, just showing the breakout here on some of these ag names. But this is a pretty broad commodity bull market that has really engaged. And a lot of the fuel came after the vaccine news, where so much of this new money rotation is starting to come into these cyclicals and in some cases the small cap space. And so this is something that that needs participation, but now you have to be much more strategic about how you get into a lot of these names.
Patrick, you're doing a webinar called Tactically Trading the Commodity Cycle, which is basically all about this. How do you apply different option strategies to getting upside participation while not taking too much downside risk? That's on Monday, December 28th at 9:45 in the morning Eastern Time. I know that people who have never used up their chance to get a free trial at Big Picture Trading have the chance to do so. How about giving people a break who've already had a free trial and let them have maybe one more just so they can get in on this one?
That's exactly what we're doing, Eric. And so I wanted to really touch on it here that I know that Kyle Bass emphasized that he focuses on trading the commodity cycle with the underlying commodities. And it's easier for a hedge fund manager to do that, that has a ISDA account and can manage some of these more complex derivative ways to access the actual commodity markets. But for most investors, there's a layer of complexity in using these derivative products. And so I like to focus on both commodities and the underlying commodity stocks, as it's more accessible to all investors. So we try to identify these multi-month commodity cycles and use those option strategies to tactically hedge and leverage them. And so I'll be reviewing these strategies with my members in that special webinar. So all Macro Voice listeners are welcome to join me with that complimentary free trial to Big Picture Trading. To make sure everyone can access that, we're resetting our system. So even if you've had a free trial in the past, you can still register and try a new free trial to make sure you get access to that webinar. So if you want to see how we actually trade these commodity cycles and go through the trades and how we manage it, please register. Again, it'll be hosted on December 28th at 9:45 a.m. Eastern Time. But if you can't attend live, the recording will be made available immediately afterward.
And we're going to leave it there for this week's show. This episode was made possible by the North Shore Global Uranium Mining ETF, ticker URNM, a focused play on miners and holders of uranium, and by Abex Technologies, pioneering the design of smarter markets that better meet the needs of both market participants and society as a whole. Patrick, what can they expect to find in this week's research roundup?
This week, you're going to find the transcript for today's interview, as well as a link to that chart book we just discussed in the postgame. There's also a link to Harley Bassman's new 2021 model portfolio, as well as a link to an article discussing an under-the-radar opportunity in LNG. So you'll find this and so much more in this week's research roundup. So that does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners, and we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we will consider it for our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account, @MacroVoices, for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter, @EricSTownsend. That's Eric spelt with a K, and myself, @PatrickSerezna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly research roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.